I think our system of government is designed for debate, and I think we need to pay more attention to the differences and disagreements that we have about our society.
So you've got to be the only person in Australia who thinks politicians need to argue more.
It hasn't exactly made me popular, no.
One for mum, one for dad, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute.
Mr. Harbourside Mansion is attacking, well, we've just heard from that great sycophant of billionaires, the leader of the opposition.
I will not be lectured about sexism and misogyny by this man. I will not.
So get rid of the car because I want to do you slowly. I want to do this.
Listening to Question Time, you'd get the impression that Canberra is a hotbed of democratic debate and discussion, where ideas and policies are argued for and against. But too often, bipartisanship actually shuts down debate rather than forging genuine consensus.
And so profound was the spirit of bipartisanship yesterday that the Leader of the Opposition and I attended the events wearing the same orange tie. So,
Dr. Andrew Carr of the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at Australian National University has a look at where this idea of bipartisanship comes from and how it works. And he's written a new report for the Australia Institute called I'm Here for an Argument, Why Bipartisanship on Security Makes Australia Less Safe. Andrew argues that while bipartisanship may seem innocuous, the reality today is far more corrosive. He describes it as kind of a default approach, which in the multi-billion dollar defence and national security space at least, really restricts policy creativity and accountability, reduces public engagement with critical issues, and actually saps national unity.
Thanks for the opportunity to have a chat, Ebony. I really appreciate it. Bipartisanship is a view that most of the Australian public, 71% according to the Australia Institute's pollings, and a majority of our politicians say is the right way to think about security issues. They're complex, they're difficult. We need to come together in a spirit of unity and cooperation in order to be able to achieve our national security, in order to be able to present a united face to the world. And in my paper, I take aim at that idea because I actually think we need to debate what's going on in the world. I think our system of government is designed for debate, and I think we need to pay more attention to the differences and disagreements that we have about our society and not just believe that the technocrats or the policy officials, even the strategic policy wonks like myself, can just solve it, all the issues.
So you've got to be the only person in Australia who thinks politicians need to argue more.
It hasn't exactly made me popular, no. But, you know, arguments actually can have good outcomes. We see in education and healthcare, we accept that this is a normal part of the process. In fact, we even have a parliamentary system that's designed for argument. There's two sides. There's someone with a formal title of leader of the opposition. And we're used to arguments being a way to find compromises, to work out what our real differences are. And yet, for the last 15, 20 years, when it's come to defence policy, we've said, oh, we can't do that. We can't afford any more arguments. But the big problem today is our uncertainty. So arguments are in some ways all we have left.
I feel like it's even more important than ever for us to discuss this with the current security climate, because it seems to me that there's a lot of risks involved in not really having the debates that we need to have when something big like North Korea comes along. If we haven't had these debates, is there a risk that some of the best ideas aren't going to be floating to the top because we're all just so busy agreeing with one another and making sure we're taking the politics out of it, so to speak.
Yeah.
Would that be accurate?
Yeah, very much so. That a lot of how Australia approaches the world today is based on a series of ideas that they had in the 1970s about, well, we'll keep the alliance despite all the problems, but seek a little bit more independence, that we would engage Asia and try and trade and increase our political relationships, that we would have a small but capable defence force. And those were the products of argument, and yet they've stayed in place. And when it was peaceful at the end of the Cold War, the early 2000s, we could afford to leave a lot of that structure in place. What we've seen more recently with the election of Donald J. Trump, with the challenges that North Korea is presenting, with China and Russia's kind of quite aggressive moves to challenge the idea of an international rules-based community, is that a lot of Australian policy really hasn't changed and hasn't evolved. And in the desire to have a bipartisan style that cooperates, we've actually said, well, alternate voices shouldn't have a role in the debate. And this is partly, I think, why a lot of our politicians like bipartisanship. It keeps a lot of those voices out of the debate. But it's precisely times like this that we need that extra creativity and, in many ways, accountability. What's going wrong and who's actually responsible? And that's a really hard discussion to have if your starting point is, well, we both agree on what we should be doing.
In your paper, which is called I'm Here for an Argument, love that title, you talk about politicians kind of avoiding talking about how they would solve problems. So picking up on what you're talking about there of, you know, we kind of had these settled ideas that we haven't really contested since then, and that stressing of cooperation. And you gave a great example, I thought, of Stephen Conroy. Can you tell me about his response to the white paper?
Yeah, no, thank you for bringing it up. I mean, part of the reason I wrote this paper is that I'd like our politicians to pay more attention to defence and security issues. I'm one of these strange people who finds this actually really interesting, and I wish everybody was like me and talked about it. But what's noticeable is that because it's an era of bipartisan cooperation, our politicians in many ways don't have to talk about it and don't have to learn about it. And I think that means the quality of their staffing and support on this issue, the kind of policy expertise they have, is lower because they're not being questioned on it and debating it. And it also means in some ways their engagement, and they are serious, they do take their responsibilities with importance, but they don't always have to go that extra mile that you might see them in education or environmental policy, for better and worse on the
latter. Those more contested areas of policy, yeah.
And so what it means is that you get an example such as in early 2016 when the new Defence White Paper was released. Massive document, hundreds, thousands of people's input, you know, spending $34 billion every year for the next 10 years. And the shadow defence minister got up and said, well, I've only just received a 186-page document. I haven't really read it because I've only just had time to start digesting it. But we're going to approach it in a spirit of cooperation. And, you know, that's what we want the Australian public to understand, that we'll try and cooperate and agree with it. And, you know, this is a massive document saying how we will spend 7.3% of what the government takes in every year, every single year. And yet the opposition's response is, oh, well, look how cooperative we are. Look at the right spirit rather than, are the decisions actually right?
Yeah, what are the details? And why is there this assumption? Why does it persist that bipartisanship is good, or that it's the way that we should operate when it comes to defence and security, when it's not how we approach probably any other policy issue?
There's two big ways to look at it. There's the kind of straightforward argument, which is that if you are bipartisan, it helps with the quality of policy. This idea that, well, if we take the politics out, we can just cooperate and find the right policy outcome. You know, we can approach this technically and rationally. That by doing so, we will have better national unity. We'll all come together in pursuit of this national aim.
The idea of, like, supporting the troops, I guess.
Yeah, and that I guess is in some ways the kind of third aspect, that because this is so important, because we are asking people to risk their lives and potentially die on behalf of our community, we need to have a slightly different approach to thinking about, well, what's their role? To not just have what people feared over the Vietnam War years as this antagonism against the troops, that would be unfair to them. So those are the three arguments that are put forward. And in the paper, I try and pull each of them apart and say, they're not really holding up, and that's particularly true for the commitment that we make to our men and women in the services, that they're not getting the support, the assistance, the oversight and management that they should be. And then there's another reason for why we have bipartisanship, and this is a slightly cynical one, but I think it's because in many ways a lot of parties outside of government at the moment haven't wanted to get into these debates, that many on the left fear that they will lose these arguments, and I don't think there's a justification for that, but they fear they're going to lose these arguments. They won't seem strong enough or tough enough on these issues, and so they would prefer to just say, well, look at the spirit of our bipartisanship. We're going to cooperate. Let's just push it aside and let's talk about issues we're more comfortable on: inequality, environment, education, all vital. But I think there are a lot of important ideas that the left can bring to these debates, as well as other alternate views that need to be heard. And to some degree, I think the left needs to have more confidence to engage in those debates.
It was a sparkling Sydney morning, giving the two protesters a perfect backdrop to paint their message before the eyes of the world. Just before nine, they scaled the outside of the largest sail and had 20 minutes to do their handiwork in thick red paver paint.
Remember when 500,000 people took to the streets to protest the Iraq War in 2003? When no war was painted on the Opera House? When politicians actually argued in Parliament against a war? Yeah, it feels like a long time ago for a reason. Andrew says our political class should fulfil its responsibility to openly debate what principles this country stands for, how we will act, and what costs we're willing to pay to protect other states and ourselves, and actually allow the public to take part in this debate.
Yeah, I think if you have a bipartisan approach, it means the general public pays less attention to it. And in some ways, there's this vicious cycle that people say, well, we can't have open public debate because the public doesn't know enough about these issues. But then we have a bipartisan approach that takes it off the newspapers, out of the public discussions, and so actually reinforces that lower levels of public knowledge. And just as an aside, I don't actually think that's accurate. I think the public does understand a lot more about these issues and wants to know more. You know, in Iraq, which is a great example, there was quite high levels of people wanting to know about what was going on, about trying to understand the issues. And in no way did our ultimate policy actually end up being harmed by the fact that we had this big public debate, this division. The men and women who served were not harmed by the fact that there was these clear divides. And in fact, we were really only trying to fool ourselves if we pretend those divides don't occur, as we have seen with the Afghanistan conflict, where public opinion has turned against it. Mm. And as I think we're seeing increasingly about our relationship with the United States, which, you know, I still see a lot of advantages for, but it's suffering a kind of death of a thousand laughs.
This thing called nuclear weapons and other things, like lots of things are done with uranium, including some bad things. I love to negotiate things. You do get good ratings, you have to admit.
Every day, people are kind of making jokes about Donald J. Trump, They are kind of laughing at what he's trying to do. And I think that's ultimately going to undermine public willingness to support or kind of engage with the Americans on the issues that we probably need to.
Mm. I think what it comes back to is kind of this idea that these things are almost too important to debate, that they're beyond debate.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
You think the public does know enough and is interested enough, but are our policy makers interested enough?
It's funny you should say that, because we keep hearing from our politicians that security issues are above politics. But I keep wondering, you know, what else is the point of politics other than the security in some ways of our society? In times of peace, we could say, okay, fine, they don't know much, but we don't have to pay a lot of attention. And I don't think that's a justification we could sustain any longer with everything that's going on in the world. And I actually think it's going to get a lot worse. I actually am quite pessimistic about some of the regional trends. And for that reason, we need to hear from the public, because there could be quite high cost to pay. And a lot of those costs could go to, well, what kind of a country are we? What kind of a society are we? What costs are we willing to pay to ensure our security or protect our neighbours, our friends in places like South Korea or the South China Sea? And therefore, you know, who are we as a people? And that's not just about security. That's about our national identity.
Mm.
But it's often debated within the security context.
It really, I think, shows up the importance of having a strong crossbench and other players in the parliament who, by virtue of there not being a majority, can start to play this type of role in the absence of one of the major parties really trying to have this contest of ideas. Are we seeing that happen in the parliament?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important point, that we have seen the minority parties to a degree standing outside of this bipartisan compact. It's, you know, the two major parties that kind of agree to cooperate. And at times, in 2010 with the Gillard government's agreement with the Greens Party, that we've actually seen some level of attempts by the minor parties to change and shape not the broader policies, but at least encouraging greater debate. And so I certainly think the small parties have a role there in encouraging it. We've had our first debates about the conflict in Afghanistan via the parliament, thanks to those agreements. But also having, I guess, a responsibility to contribute, that smaller parties are often single issue or very small resources. You know, if you look at, say, Nick Xenophon's party, he's had a significant impact on moving the submarines and where we built the submarines in South Australia. And he says, oh, well, I'm doing it for South Australians and things. But he also needs to engage with that larger strategic debate about, well, why do we need submarines? How do we need them? What kind do we need? And how much are we willing to spend? And you can't just say, well, this is about manufacturing. That's a really bad way to do industry policy via the defence organisation.
The White Paper talks in terms of the need for joint force capability, and that's absolutely right.
Conduct freedom of navigation operations consistent
in the significant capability development and acquisition programs that we have.
Just like economists and politicians try to shut down public debate by using a conabubble or language that excludes large sections of the community, Andrew argues that security babble is also a big problem, and it discourages public engagement with issues around defence, defence spending and security measures.
Yeah, very much so. And in fact, the latest episode of Utopia kind of pokes great mirth at this and has great fun, so strongly recommended. There's a lot of acronyms, there's a lot of past terms about Indo-Pacific, Asia and, you know, force structuring for regional uncertainty and capability challenges. That really is often designed to exclude the public, or at least is done under the assumption that, well, you know, the public can catch up to speed or get involved if they want to, but we need to push ahead with the discussions we want. And, you know, that's problematic. That doesn't actually pay attention to where the public engages on these issues. But in some ways, it's also used to kind of prevent clear thought. It's used to argue for certain sectional interests. And there's a long history of our three services saying, well, the Navy can have their ships as long as the Army gets their tanks and the Air Force gets their planes, and everybody coming away happy. You know, there's no limit to how much we could spend on defence. There's no limit to how many tanks and machine guns we might need to buy in worst case scenarios. But making accurate judgments about that actually is about those trade-offs. And those trade-offs aren't so much technical as they are political. How much do we value our defence and our security versus our environment, our economy, our society? What's the minimum level? What's the most cost-effective way we can do it?
Yeah.
But we do need to recognise the difficulties that are out there in the world, and perhaps we do need higher levels of support. So we need to kind of consider those trade-offs, and that has to be a public decision and that has to be a political decision. And I think the only way to get there is by actually arguing about it. You know, we, for all that we discuss the capability, we haven't really spent very much time talking about, well, what do we actually need them for?
Yeah.
And, you know, could we actually use other kinds of assets to achieve the same aim? You know, talking strategy instead of talking kind of just the dollars and just the particular upgrades. And in some ways, these kind of technical questions often do exclude the public, or the public feel, well, you know, how much can I actually contribute to that? But the public does have a very strong understanding about their own place in the world, and I'm confident that if you give them the opportunity to engage in these areas, they will pay attention. There was this debate from Nick Xenophon and the Labor Party and others that we had to do an Australian build. Members of the coalition often wanted to look to Japan and purchasing offshore. And bringing this out into the public, even in the way that it came out through the kind of almost attempted spill of the first Abbott Prime Ministership, actually led to Australia changing its capability acquisition process.
Yep.
Sorry, that's a jargon term I've slipped into there. Changing the way we bought the submarines and changing it to a way that instead of us going to a foreign country and saying, we'd like to buy 12 of your best submarines, please tell us how much, we actually had the other countries coming to us and bidding and saying, well, what could be the right, what do you want and how can we do it better than our competitors?
Yeah.
So this public debate not only helped to bring the public into it, but I think actually ended up with a much better process, because we were able to have that leverage of saying, well, you know, these people are bidding to buy our product, and we can hopefully get better dollar for money, more efficiency. And so you've actually seen a very good outcome out of what started as a, you know, a quite cynical partisan attempt to try and bring money and manufacturing and votes to South Australia.
Breaking new details about North Korea's missile launch. Kim Jong-un's regime firing what's believed to be an intermediate-range ballistic missile over Japanese airspace.
China's visiting premier has dismissed suggestions that Beijing is militarizing the waters of the South China Sea.
If North Korea has developed a capability of deploying an intercontinental ballistic missile as far as the United States, then Australia is within range.
We will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
It seems as though there's something new and alarming on the news every week about threats to our global security. But Andrew Carr argues that Australia's security position hasn't really changed much since the 1950s. He says there's a reluctance by politicians to even revisit our defence or security policy, but that's the wrong approach.
In many ways, I think that disagreement about what's going on is actually really reflective of where we are as a country, that we are uncertain about what the world is doing, we are uncertain about how we should respond, but we've had these periods of uncertainty before in the 1960s and the early 1970s. We had very partisan, very big arguments about defence and security policy. And it didn't. We actually didn't change our defence policy for a while, but it then led to and built up an actually really firm foundation of agreement about what our defence policy should be that then lasted for 30 years. So even though you might have more gridlock, more status quo for a few years, it actually gives you that opportunity to build a new foundation.
A strong consensus.
Yeah, I think that's right. And a way that will actually kind of sustain it in the face of future challenges.
When you're talking at the level of national security and defence policy, it's not something you can chop and change according to the nature of domestic politics. So it actually is a long-term benefit in being able to find a foundation that can be agreed upon for not just a couple of election cycles, but decades, as you've indicated. It's long-term horizons.
I mean, there certainly is this belief that, oh, we can't just kind of chop and change and move about on this issue. But I actually think sometimes you need to do a little bit more of that. You know, that's difficult when you're talking submarines and 30-year kind of it takes to buy and build them. But, you know, as far back as the 16th century, Niccolò Machiavelli, you know, the famous author of The Prince, that hard-nosed political kind of activist, actually made an argument saying democracies and kind of non-monarchical societies would do better at foreign and defence policy because they were more flexible, because they were able to respond to a changing world and say, you know what, the past hasn't worked. We need to take a different approach. We need to reconsider this. And actually being willing to change when things weren't working. And, you know, we may look at the world and see someone, a country like China or Russia or North Korea, and say, you know, they're led by a strong man, going in a single direction, they look like they know what they're doing. But the history of the 20th century is these kinds of countries are actually very brittle, very weak. They don't always have good flow of information, and they're very poor at changing course when things aren't going right.
Yeah.
For Australia and for the West today, a lot isn't going right. And I think we actually need more willingness to say, well, how do we change and introduce that flexibility?
Something like the South China Sea, which has been bubbling away for ages. I certainly don't know the ins and outs of it, but there doesn't seem to be, you know, a clear pathway on that. And again, dealing with, you know, such an uncertain and unpredictable regime like North Korea doesn't really seem like you could set a kind of game plan and stick to it. You would have to be flexible, I guess, in those types of quickly changing security environments. And, yeah, being able to have the debates in public, I guess, is going to lead to much better outcomes than just leaving it to a few people.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at something like North Korea, there's, you know, technocratic options that we can talk about, and we can talk about, you know, what kind of forces could we deploy. Ultimately, it comes down to what is the Australian public willing to do in the case of a conflict?
Yeah.
Would we be willing to return to the Korean Peninsula as we did in 1950 to 1953? What level of support and resources are we willing to pay? And unless the Australian political leaders and military leaders understand what the Australian public is willing to support, they can't actually make their policies with any great coherence.
Mm.
So a lot of this actually does come to the public. And I think, you know, the public also need to pay great attention to this, not just kind of say, oh, it's all too difficult, or, oh, you know, let's just leave it to the boffins. You know, part of my argument saying, you know, I'm here for an argument, and I actually think the rest of the Australian public need to say, as citizens, it's part of our responsibility to learn about the world, the bad parts as well as the good parts, and to take this responsibility seriously when you vote, when you talk to your local members of politics, of parliament, you know, engaging on defence and security issues, and not just those that kind of fit our more kind of natural interests or kind of ideological bent. And that's partly why we need to get some of these ideas like bipartisanship or just that this is an elite issue out of the way so that we can have those broader discussions.
That's been episode 22 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute on September 21, 2017. You can find Andrew's report critiquing bipartisanship on our website at tai.org.au, where you'll also find more information in the podcast show notes, and you can listen to our back catalogue of episodes. If you like Follow the Money, you might also like our chief economist Richard Dennis's new podcast series, The Lucky Country. It's a weekly podcast in which Richard digs into the economics and politics of what really matters in this lucky country of ours. You can subscribe via the Saturday Paper's website, www.thesaturdaypaper.com.au/theluckycountry, or wherever you get your podcasts from. We'd like to thank Andrew Carr from the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at ANU for joining me on Follow the Money and for teaming up with the Institute to write the report. We're always up for a good argument. Andrew is on Twitter at AO Carr with a double R. The Australia Institute is at the Oz Institute with an AUS. And I'm at Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Hit us up on Twitter or Facebook if you want to have an argument with us. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum composed our title track. You can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Additional music composed by Paul Macy. Thanks for listening.